Hi, welcome to this week's BFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, coming to you via satellite, I guess, well, or underwater cable. I have in the studios Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
I'm great. It's happy to be here. It's fun to go for it again to another experiment, this time on the Google Hangout.
Yes. And Jason Diamond, how are you, sir?
How's it going?
So last time we tried this, which was a while ago, in the technological, evaluation of Google Hangouts, we actually screwed up the audio sync. So if you're watching this now and we're getting accurate audio sync, I'd love you to email us and let us know. But we hopefully we've solved a whole bunch of technical problems as we are trying to give you, obviously, a more interesting VFX show. Now, what we're going to do this week is a standard VFX show, and as we did last time, we'll put out the audio as normal. But for those of you that are looking down the road, you'll obviously guess that in the future we'll schedule these and advertise them more in advance so that people can actually join us for a live presentation. And one of the advantages of doing a live presentation as such in the Google Hangout is we can play things, clips, stills, some imagery to give you a bit more context. So with that in mind, let's kick off the show by looking at the trailer for this week's film, which is Rush.
Emergency. That was the racetrack. There's been an accident. The driver's been injured. He's coming in now.
Hello. I think the racetrack telephoned ahead that I was coming. Hunt. James Hunt.
I had a friendly disagreement with another driver about his wife.
Why? What did he do?
I'd be happy to show you if you like.
James, you'd be a loose cannon. But in terms of raw talent, there is no better driver in the world.
Why don't they make it safer?
Risk of death turns people
off. Who's that?
It's Niki Lauda. He's just been signed by Ferrari.
They're both quicker than you. We'd bet on setting up the car.
James Hunt is a proven winner at the highest level.
Is there a question? Why, you're just trying to piss me off.
This is an incredible battle between these two drivers.
I heard about this thing with Nikki.
Everyone has.
James, do you think you can cope with the pressure?
To be a champion, you have to really believe it.
You're just a party guy.
They're killing us out there.
You're too far back.
I'm quicker than all of you.
And James Hunt is out.
It's over.
More powerful than even the fear of death itself is the will to win.
Which is why I'm here, begging. You really think you can beat him?
Trust me.
Today with the rain, it's the most dangerous trick in the world.
That all depends on how good you are in the rain.
Let's race.
Talk to me, James.
Don't go to men who are willing to kill themselves driving circles looking for normality.
Nicky Lauda, trapped in a searing inferno of 800 plus degrees.
Responsible for what happened.
Watching you win those races, you were equally responsible for getting me back in the car.
Showdown between you and Nikki is all anyone wants to see.
Well, that is the trailer from Rush. That'll see if there are YouTube's automatic copyright detection thing freaks out. Of course, we have permission to do a review show, but that's another matter. Okay, so we're going to discuss, of course, as we do, the visual effects of the film. But before we do that, let's get into a discussion whether we liked the film at all. So starting with you, Matt, was this a film that you enjoyed? Were you, in fact, really looking forward to it?
Yeah, you know, I actually was really looking forward to it. And I thought it was great. I think it's one of those ones, though, that it's really interesting. I really enjoyed this movie. I'm a fan of Ron Howard, maybe not all of his movies, but certainly as a filmmaker, as an artist, I think he makes some really interesting work, makes some interesting choices. And I think, historically, a racing film is something that's really been, I think, extraordinarily difficult to do well. You can go back and watch John Frankenheimer's movie Grand Prix with Eva Marie Saint, right, and James Garner, which has an amazingly gorgeous opening montage, probably the best part of the movie, which is the part that was directed by and optically printed by Saul Bass, And there were a lot of sort of homages to that, I think, in this film. But then there's also the Steve McQueen film, Le Mans, and then, of course, the Tony Scott movie, Days of Thunder, right? And I think all of those films, all three of those previously mentioned films, you know, have moments that are good, but there are things about them that are really difficult. And I was a little bit nervous about this film. I didn't actually know historically the real story. I wasn't sure if they'd be able to pull it off. I knew it would look great. I thought all the stuff I saw in the trailer looked great, but I think the script really held up really well in this too. And not knowing the actual narrative, I was thoroughly entertained. I really, really enjoyed it. And I loved the look of the film, the grade that they gave to the picture, I thought was really nice. So yeah, I totally dug it. I was totally impressed, and I really enjoyed it. Walked out of the theater feeling, you know, pumped.
So, Jason, this is effectively an indie film in the sense that Ron Howard went to Hollywood to try and get it funded. It was deemed to not be something that it wanted to fund. The budget got changed. In fact, the director got changed to Ron Howard, who was just a producer initially. So it's come in at about, I think, $38 million for the budget of the entire feature film, though it's already grossed, like, you know, $200 million. What did you think of it, and did it feel in any way like it wasn't a full-budget Hollywood film? Did it feel any different to you, Jason?
No, it felt like a like a big budget film. Actually, I went into this film pretty blank. I think I saw the trailer once. I don't know if I would have seen it initially or had the drive to see it. No pun intended. If we weren't doing a show on it, but I'm really glad I went because I really liked it, and I agree with Matt on a lot of things. I'm partial to the film Le Mans. And I think that this had a lot of the same style. And maybe I'm thinking about it in retrospect because I loved the grade. And I loved the look of the film. I thought it was incredible. Fit the period really well. I mean, it still had the teal and orange modern-ish grade, but it felt like the 70s. And also one of the best uses of Thin Lizzy's The Rocker that you could use. But I think that I found myself in the beginning, knowing that Ron Howard usually, or I think has only shot film until this movie, saying, well, clearly this is film, because it looked like film. I mean, it had the squishiness.
And they're intercutting stock footage, and that stock footage would have been shot on film because the stock footage was from an era before digital cameras. So I think you're right. They needed to balance those up well, and I think they did balance them up well.
Is that true? Is it the first movie he's ever shot digitally?
Yeah.
I believe so, yeah. Because he's working with Anthony Dodd Mantle on this film, who, of course, won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire, which was famously done on the SI2Ks. And so on this, they were shooting on the Alexa. Well, not entirely on the Alexa. I mean, they used Phantoms and stuff for the super slow-mo stuff, and they had some smaller cameras. But, yeah, and I think it was a really interesting cinematic mix. And when it went to the stock footage, I didn't feel like, yeah, sometimes you get the stock footage shot and you feel like, well, they're using this shot because they just literally can't afford to do this for real.
I could really only tell that it was stock footage just by looking at the people and knowing that those people don't exist now, you know, just in their vibe. But it was really only a vibe thing from the actual people in the footage, not a look. Like, everything was seamless to me, personally. I also don't know a single thing about racing. I don't really know it much about cars in general. And I was thoroughly entertained. Like, the whole racing thing was easily explained and left as a sort of second layer, and the character work was just stellar, I thought. And the guy
who
played,
what I thought was good about the racing is we didn't get into the racing too soon. By the time we got into the racing, we cared about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
If it had started out with a really big race event and that would have gone on for a long time, then I think you would have kind of shut down if you went into racing. But it felt to me like there was some racing, but there was a lot of character stuff. By the time we started getting to the racing, it could have been jousting, it could have been the Olympics, sure, it could have been any form of, like, competition. It just felt like, okay, now I want to pay attention because I care about the characters.
Well, also because they started with what turned out to be a very pivotal race and then went backwards. You, as a viewer, or me, who had no idea, knew that they were going to get to a place of notoriety and competition. We go back to the Formula 3, and you automatically understand that you're getting the trajectory storyline. And so it gives you a sense of comfort and sort of balance as a viewer to know where you are, so that you can just let the information fall into the stack as you move forward instead of having to find your way.
But I mean, like, if they'd spent the first 15, 20 minutes on a race, like a big battle race, then I think it would have been wrong. But they established it obviously with that initial shot. But what I mean is they just didn't sit in race nuance kind of minutiae.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah. That's actually, because we're talking about the DOP and stuff, and I want to get your opinion on this, Jason. Let's bring up some stills while we're talking of the camera rig. So I don't know if you know this map, there's about 30 Arri Alexas used at the height of like the filming, independent film, so they're really like pulling stuff out of the gate. But actually, if we go to the camera stack first, rather than the effects stack, that would be great. There's a huge variety of cameras, and one of the things that I was lucky enough to do was actually speak to the DOP as part of the RC podcast, and it was really interesting. He was talking about the fact they had these what are called Russian arms, which are follow vehicles with super stabilizers on them, and he said they were great, but he actually got rid of them because they were too stable, they were too pretty, they were too gorgeous in terms of their almost mathematical precision, and he wanted to get some of the danger and I think he described sex appeal back into the shot. So a lot of these action cams and stuff that we're going to show, if you're watching the YouTube feed, show really clearly like how small some of these cameras were and how they were kind of mounted. Obviously there was helicopter stuff, this is to be expected, but some of the rigs, there's some shots coming up in a second where they've got a track, like a little slider on the front of a modified Formula 3 / Formula 1 car. There it is right now. That's an extraordinary thing to do, don't you think?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah, really cool. And I think, too, that, you know, getting that kind of aesthetic that they got in the racing sequences itself, where there was a lot of really high frequency kind of, you know, vibration and stuff, it really made you feel like you were, you know, in the cockpit with the driver, or you were right there, you know, in the moment. And I think that's a really interesting choice. It would have been interesting to see in contrast, like, the super stabilized footage. But I thought that the kinetic energy of the way the imagery was captured using maybe some of these smaller rigs was really great. It really did. That coupled with some of the shots that were like these insert shots where you would see, in the cockpit looking up from sort of down by their feet or looking down towards where they're, you know, shifting gears. And then you every once in a while would see shots that looked like of valves and pistons. And I don't know if those were digital shots or what. I assume they were.
Probably were, but yeah.
I would imagine they were, yeah.
But those were so great, and it really put you in the space.
Yeah, being the complete noob on racing, I felt like those shots really helped you understand the geography of what they were doing, right? So when the guy is shifting and you realize that he has like 5 inches from his knee to his hand, and yet they're doing these fine precision movements. I also liked the camera that was like right in their eyeballs. That's super close up. I thought that was really nice. I really liked the fact that there wasn't a lot of wides. Mm-hmm. And when you went for the racing, and when you went to the wides, it was usually stock footage on a TV, like TV coverage wides. And it's kind of the Rocky trick, right? Like Rocky wouldn't be exciting if you had a camera in the nosebleeds in the garden while the two guys are fighting Tiny. You want to be in there and feel like you're in the ring with them. And by being in the – literally in the driver's seat, or I really liked the shots where the camera was on the ground and it would be facing this way, and they'd go by, and then they'd cut to the other side, and it would go away, sort of the Star Trek-y kind of shot, or the leaves would blow into camera. Like, all that stuff that made you feel like, holy shit, these guys are going really fast.
Let me ask you a question about this, because in talking to the DOP, I personally really like talking to DOPs about how they do blocking and setting up shots. And so I asked the DOP about this. So he made this point, which I'm now going to repeat, which is that when they were doing the close-ups, the shots out of the cars with the characters, Niki Lauda, because he was such a disciplined guy, the camera would be incredibly disciplined. Like it would do either a move left or right or in or out. It was like he was framed in the shot. It was very deliberate. No point did he look like there was any kind of hunt and seek on it. By contrast, when the British driver Hunt, who was a much wilder guy, The DOP described him as, you know, like a caged animal. So they were always trying to have him kind of not properly framed and butting up against the edge of frame. And the camera was much more fluid and moving around trying to find him. He was kind of moving in the wrong way relative to the camera movement. Did you guys sense that at all? That like the actual composition of the shots on there, behind the scenes, behind the racing kind of footage, was one way for one actor's performance of an English motor racer and another for a German's performance?
I didn't notice that, but hearing you describe that, I love that description. I think, that's such an interesting thing about choices that you can make in the context of filmmaking, creative choices too, that you would make in what effectively, you know, as you mentioned earlier, an independent film, you know, a marketably lower budget maybe than the quality of what you see on screen. And I think those kind of choices, making those kind of decisions and really thinking about things in that sort of language of cinema, and then having those elements take place within the film, if you don't notice them literally, maybe you are noticing them, you know, in some subconscious way, right? That's sort of the intent anyway, is that it's something that, you know, just sort of comes across in the energy that's sort of, coming off the screen. And I think, that kind of thing is just is such a cool idea. And whether or not, you know, it winds up, you know, even subliminally having an effect, I mean, it's a pretty neat thing to try.
Go on.
I was going to say, I feel like while you're talking about that, I was thinking about the shots, and I felt like that maybe they shot Chris Hemsworth, James Hunt, lower. You know, they weren't always up at his eye line. He always seemed a little bigger. I mean, he's a big dude anyway, but I felt like they were sort of always a little under him. I could be misremembering. But
yeah, I think you're right. I remember it that way as well. And I'm going to say, I think it's pretty funny that, you know, that actor played that role, because Formula One guys are a bit like jockeys, right? You don't want a big, heavy guy in the car because it's going to add weight to the car. So he had to apparently lose a lot of what you might call Hulk Avengers size. And there was a great quote from him where he said that he went to bed every night and woke up every morning just thinking about food. He was completely just on a starvation diet to get down to even a plausible kind of size for him to get into one of those cars. The film, the other quote that I love from this film is from Ron Howard, where he said, "This is an era when the sex was safe and the cars were dangerous." I felt that they did a pretty good job of capturing a non-out-of-control danger. Like this Niki Lauda concept of, like, there's a 20% chance when I get in the car I'm going to die, but I'm willing to accept just that and not 1% more. I felt that came over well. Like, it didn't feel like they were completely cavalier. Even Hunt didn't feel like he was completely, you know, had a death wish, and it wasn't just random. But by the same token, you had this great sense of them just being on the edge of what was possible.
Yeah, there was definitely an element of real seriousness in regards to, you know, their kind of professionalism with when it came to the races themselves. I think, you know, off the track, the James Hunt character certainly was the international playboy, as it were. But I even think that was something that, again, not knowing the story, I found that, you know, spoiler alert, right? But that in the in the epilogue, we find out that that James Hunt, you know, he had this whole philosophy that he kept espousing throughout, where it's like, you know, it's important that you have fun, and this idea of living each day as if it were your last. And then it turned out he died, right, at the age of like 44 or 45, of a heart attack. And I thought that was kind of cool that they never alluded to any of that throughout the film. But then you sort of get that in the epilogue, and it resonates. It harkens back to all the kind of things that you heard him saying in the context of the film, and not knowing his biography at all, I actually thought that was kind of cool that they didn't even really allude to it early on. It was just this thing that, you know, made what had been said earlier in the script all that much more poignant. And I thought that was a really, and he did such a great job, I think, in that role. My wife went and saw it with me just yesterday. And, she, of course, you know, loved watching, Thor walk around and do his thing. But at the same time, too, you know, we both kind of commented after the fact that, it was neat to see him in a role like this, because he actually, I think, got to act, you know, and do something other than being, you know, a guy in a cape. He really, he filled the shoes of that role really well. And I thought really, and both actors really did, both of the lead actors anyway, I thought were really strong.
I thought that end sequence when they were talking in the aircraft hangar was some good acting. You know, you had this real sense of, I mean, I don't know how true that is, but it just, the actors were giving some really interesting nuanced performances. There was more than going on that was just sort of meeting the surface there. And I thought that was great. And the other thing I wanted to touch on just before you get onto the visual effects is, in this film, as in the film about, what was the film where they went into and got the hostages out in...
Argo?
Argo, thank you. At the end of Argo, they showed you actual footage from stuff that they had referenced in the film. And I found that fascinating.
Yeah.
I found it fascinating again in this film when we actually got to see Niki Lauda for real.
Yeah,
as well as footage of Hunt. I don't know what you guys think about that in terms of it kind of breaks the illusion. You know, it's a nod to the audience. Well, obviously, it was a guy because he's the real guy.
I found it amazing.
I did,
honestly.
Too.
Honestly, like that... That, like, solidified my emotional connection to the story. Like, I was already in, and I was like, oh, wow, this is really good. I really like this. I even texted my brother during the movie because I was like, oh, do you want to come see it with me? He's like, no, I don't have any interest in seeing that. And halfway through, I was like, dude, this movie's awesome. And then, you know, you figure the story's going to end, and that little epilogue just, like, drove a tiny little knife in my heart. It was, like, just enough to make me just – really care about the dudes,
yeah,
and make the connection, like you were saying, Mike, like to see it for real. Now you have me interested, right? I didn't know anything about Formula One. Now I have all this information about what is potentially one of the greatest rivalries and whatever. I've learned about cars just enough. I've learned about the business just enough and what have you. And now I get to see the dudes for real, make my own comparisons. And I when they said that, what's his name, James Hunt died at 45, like, I teared up.
See, like, I was really like... interesting, and the reason I brought up Argo is that when I saw the flashbacks then, it was like, look how clever we were in reconstructing these horrendous
right.
events. And by horrendous events, I mean, there was a shot of a guy hung, I presume it was a guy, and, you know, this was a shot we'd seen earlier in the film, and so it was like, oh, my God, that person obviously was hung on the streets. And but there was almost a bit like, we just want to show you how faithful we were to events.
Right.
In this film, you got, well, this is how faithful we were to events. And, oh, by the way, let me just give you a little poignant piece of advice about life, because this is what happened to one of these two characters.
Yeah.
That just put a whole different tint over the story.
Yeah, when they showed Niki Lauda at the end as an old man,
yeah,
like having seen that James Hunt died and seeing Niki Lauda at the end for real as an old man was just like, seriously, like I had a tear in my eye. I was just like, holy crap.
It validated Nikki's decision to pull out of that, was it the Japanese Tokyo?
Yeah.
Because it validated that, because he's still alive today. And so it was really interesting, I thought, in terms of story. It gave a, I don't know, a motivation, I don't know what, but it gave a validation to earlier parts of the story. So, okay,
well, because,
I'm glad you guys thought the same way.
Because in the driver's meeting, he says, you know, they're like, oh, you're just scared. He's like, hell yeah, I'm scared. I don't want to die. Like, this is our job. It's like, I'm not going to go to the stapler factory if I know it's going to blow up. You know what I mean? Like, I like that they portrayed the characters not as heroes, as like regular dudes who were just really good at what they did. And
yeah.
I really.
And a bit mean as well. I mean, you know, yes, I'm a rat. I look like a rat. It's easy to make.
Yeah.
I'm thinking you wouldn't be on set the day that Niki Lauda was there. Sorry. I'm just,
yeah.
Sorry.
That guy was awesome. I, you know, like, Chris Hemsworth and Olivia Wilde were really the only known people, right?
Yeah.
In the whole movie. And I think everyone else was incredible. Like, every performance was dead on.
Yeah. So Jason Wingrove said to me, because he's a huge, you know, fan of the sport,
yeah,
he hadn't seen the film yet, he said, oh, it's Nixon on wheels. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, I don't think it is. I think it's a different film than that. And I think that does it justice. Would you agree?
I don't know if I get the reference.
Well, you know, there was the film where it was Nixon, right? Where Frost Nixon Diaries.
Yeah.
And so it was two men.
But that's every. I mean, every plot has a protagonist and an antagonist. It's not like it's specific to any. I mean, it's Rocky. You could just say it's Rocky. To you know. You could say it's any other.
I would almost say there's a movie. There's like, it's almost, you know, more apt to something like, you know, Amadeus or something, you know, where there's the Mozart and the Salieri character or something, where they're rivals, you know. And that's the story, right? It's these, and whereas Frost Nixon weren't really rivals per se, they were more, you know, it was a former president and an interviewer engaged in a
there's
singular
There's no parallel. Interview. There's no peer interaction. Like, this is a peer. Rocky's a peer. You know, Mozart and Salieri were peers. You know, I don't know. I and also the fact that they would. I don't think they actually hated each other. It was that they had a rivalry and they disliked each other's actions, but I don't think they had any intention for the other one to get, you know, hurt.
You certainly got the impression at the end that they had, and I assume this is, you know, true, but you really got the feeling at the end that there was there was that rivalry, and maybe there were things that they didn't like about one another. Certainly they were very different. But they respected one another. They respected one another's skills on the racetrack or whatever. And I think, you know, that final scene in the airplane hangar, you know, it's almost as if they both felt like there was a little bit that they learned from one another too. You know, that changed both of them to some degree. So the rivalry changed
and
them.
Look, you know, honestly, my entire life's driven trying to be better than Matt because Matt's so good at what he does and such a sort of authority on stuff in the world that, you know, having the rivalry with Matt, obviously Matt, you are, you know, you in this role, by the way, I would be the Niki Lauda character, the dull one, and you would be the sex charmed guy. But, you know, it serves a purpose. Okay, so let's move to the VFX and discuss that. So a couple of things. There's an article on FX Guide about this, and we have some footage we'll be putting out to show, but just for today, we want to just discuss it in terms of the work that primarily DNEG did. Now, there was some work by Pixelmondo, but DNEG's pretty much the house of choice. So this isn't a mega-budget film, but the challenges they had, I guess some of them are really obvious. You don't want to actually crash a car, and you don't actually want to place anyone in danger on a film set. But more than that, they couldn't really film at a lot of the racetracks that had existed back then because a lot of those racetracks are not sort of working anymore. And in addition to the racetracks that they couldn't go to, there are places that you could go to because that's where Formula One is held, like Monaco, but that would be prohibitively expensive to set up. If you're Iron Man, what was that, Iron Man 2, you can afford to do that kind of stuff, but they didn't have that kind of money. So there was this use of stock footage, and then there was this integration of an enormous amount of set extensions and background plates into stuff that was moving pretty quickly. But for those people that are interested in motorsport, and certainly because of the stock footage, you had a pretty good reference of what that should have looked like. It's not maybe iconic in the sense that you're recreating, you know, the JFK shooting or something where everybody knows the footage. But there were enough people out there that knew these tracks and these environments. You couldn't just kind of make it all up. So I guess starting with you, Matt, what did you think of the work of DNEG in terms of the environments before we get to the crash and the cars?
Yeah, I mean, I thought the environments were really strong. I thought there were a lot of really intelligent things that were done, both on the visual effects level as well as the incorporation of the visual effects within to the larger construction of the race scenes. And with regards specifically to the environments, I thought it was really smart the way they introduced each race with kind of a super, right? There was like a little placard that came up with the race, the date, and the location of that race. And then they would do things both in terms of the establishing of the environment, you know, some of the crowds, some of the kind of maybe the grandstands, some sort of iconic thing that maybe people might recognize, maybe who are real aficionados of that era. And then they would do things editorially as well in terms of the way that the sequence would be cut so that they cut sort of quickly and sort of seamlessly around some of these different events using, and I didn't actually know they used any found footage. I thought, I thought it just worked so well. I didn't realize they were I thought they were just recreating found footage and, you know, it all kind of had that same sort of grade to it that made it look like it was from that era with sort of the muted, some of the muted colors and whatnot. But, I thought that the environment work was really great, and I never would have known until reading about it after the fact that they didn't actually go to all these different locations and shoot on different tracks. I guess they shot on only really one or two tracks in England, right, is what I understand.
They did also shoot in Germany, but they couldn't shoot at the particular point on the track where the accident happened because it's covered in graffiti and flowers and kind of tributes. Jason, let me ask you, because in talking to the DOP, he surprised me a little by saying that he loved DI, and DI was his thing, and he was, like, totally focused on getting his results through the DI, both in terms of matching stock footage and not, but just getting his looks. He wasn't a DP that begrudgingly went to DI. It was like his playground, I think he described it as. And you can hear that in the interview in the RC. But you mentioned the grade before. How viable do you think those grades were in selling those visual effect shots, those 3D environments, the stadiums, the entire cities, into selling those shots in as real?
Well, having like that really squishy look to the footage in general really helped. I mean, I think he said in that article that he used old Super Baltars and Cook S2s, which are like, you know, beautiful, all great glass, but, you know, at this point in history, they're soft, you know, or at this point in time compared to Master Primes or like Somaluxes or what have you.
And Master Primes from Sir.
Yeah, I mean, I would have too. I mean, why would you shoot a period piece with modern glass? I would never do that personally either. But, and I think it said he put all sorts of filters, you know, soft effect filters in front of the lens also to sort of get the highlights to bloom certain ways. And I think he spent so much time trying to really get the Alexa to look, you know, really soft and squishy and gorgeous that they probably had a really good reference for matching from DNEG to do in the digital stuff, which I think, again, like Matt, like I had zero idea how much visual effects were in this film.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It felt...
Let's bring up stills as we're talking, because we've got some stills showing some before and afters of those environments for those of you that are on the feed. So you'll see shots. We've basically tried to keep this... we'll just get this rolling through as we're talking, but we kind of keep this as A and B so you could see what was and what wasn't done. I mean, you obviously want to have
that's amazing.
Yeah. But I mean, there's some of the stands in the close-up areas, but the distance stands, all of those crowds were added in. And and of course, that's a large proportion of what you want. And then not only that, but you've got to match all those atmospherics.
Right.
Damn. Seeing those breakdowns, like, you know, for anybody who's just listening to the audio show, if you get a chance to go and maybe go, if you have them on the site or something, Mike, like, I mean, those... Yeah, that's amazing. Like, I had no idea. Those are really cool. That's really impressive.
When they were crashing cars and stuff, those were CG cars. Obviously, they're not going to crash real cars, especially because...
We've got some shots of those as well. Get the guys to bring up some of the extra VFX shots of the cars. Yes, they were digital cars that were... Well, the cars that they were racing with were primarily cars that were... Formula 3 that were modified to look like Formula 1, and then obviously when anything happened, they would put in digital cars that were matching the real Formula 1s. There were some real Formula 1 cars used, but they couldn't risk them very much because they're so valuable. Mm-hmm. I think even their own owners had to drive them. It was for insurance reasons. So, yeah, it was an astounding piece of... I mean, I guess shiny cars is something we do in 3D, but still, I think it worked pretty well.
Well, I don't think they were overly... I mean, I know you didn't mean it specifically this way, but they weren't, like, super glossy, you know, beauty shots of the cars. Really, I don't think they ever sort of car-porned out on any of the cars in the film. I wouldn't hesitate to use the word gorgeous. I mean, it looked like film. Like, I swear to God, I had no question in my mind that this was shot on film.
Yeah.
The grain, I don't know what grain overlay they used on the Alexa stuff. And they were shooting Arri Raw too, which is, you know, I don't even know if that was necessarily needed since I don't know how much green screen work was on this, but it didn't look like a lot since they were in open environments.
Yeah, we've seen quite a lot of the making of stuff from behind the scenes, and I didn't see a lot of green screen. I saw a lot of these environments where they took stuff and then, you know, did massive set extension. But, I mean, there's not much point on set extensions doing greens because you'd need kilometers of the stuff for the back of stands and stuff. The actual crash, I'm sorry, I'm just going to beg the guys to just keep up the VFX shots if they can rather than me. I don't know if it's possible. The actual crash stuff, and this isn't the one right now we're seeing, it's the crash later, but Niki Lauda's crash on the ring where he actually plows into it and stuff, and obviously at that point it's pretty dramatic. Interestingly, it was filmed by a kid with, I believe, a Super 8 camera, and if you do a Google search of some documentaries from back in the day, you'll find that. In the film, they actually flashed up to somebody filming it from the deck. But I've got to say, I thought it was pretty interesting to have this reference footage of whatever that was. How many years ago was that? Like 30, 40 years ago. Some kid shot. Did not a bad job. But then if you actually sort of A and B between the Super 8 footage that is on YouTube and what you saw in the film, which a geek like me actually bothered to do, they got it really accurate. I mean, the amount of times it spun around, the way the flames were going, like it was really faithful. And it's easy enough to do a simulation in a computer when, you know, you set it up and it does what it does. It's another thing to drive the simulation so it's a very exact model to what actually happened. In other words, you have to get your input physics pretty right to get your output sims to look accurate if you're trying to match to a real-world event in the way that a crash reconstruction of a, you know, in a forensic sense would be done. So I think, you know, it was a good job.
Yeah, I thought the Niki Lauda crash was really great. It was spectacular and appropriately horrifying, right? You really got a strong sense of the jeopardy that he was actually in being, I guess they said he was trapped in the car for a minute, right, in really super high intensity heat. And it made the subsequent images of him in sort of in recovery, and in particular the part where he's trying so hard to put the helmet on and then they're pulling part of the stuff off, I mean, it really made both me and my wife kind of queasy watching it. It was pretty nasty stuff, but really well done. There was one other crash, though. Just speaking directly of the crash visual effects, there was a crash that took place earlier in the film where there's a, I think it's actually one of the first crashes we see, where there's a Formula One car that crashes into a wall. And I actually thought that crash looked like a visual effects shot. And it's the only one that I felt that way about in the entire film. And if I was going to try to say why I felt that way, I think the thing that really jumped out at me as a, you know, with a long history as a, really as a compositor more than anything else, the thing that really jumped out was I felt like the crumpling in the front, sort of like the front wing of the vehicle as it sort of crumples when it hits the, if I remember the crash correctly, it's like it hits the sidewall and the car kind of the back lifts up and it kind of crumples down, and the crumpling and the pieces that come off, like they just, it looked like a procedural kind of a shatter. You know what I mean? It looked like what it was to me, rather than, it didn't feel like it had the same kind of chaotic, organic feel that I think a lot of the later and other crashes in the film did have. It was just one crash in particular. And if memory serves, it was the first crash that we see of a Formula One car.
They hear the ambulance sounds and you get that kind of sense of foreboding. Obviously one of the problems you've got with these things is that we have our imagined idea of what something should look like, and then the reality, you know, that may or may not be different. In the case of the Niki Lauda crash, what you'd expect it to look like is what it looked like, which is what they recreated. I know some of the materials in some of these cars shatters differently than like a normal car, because, you know, it's not got the kind of metallic paneling that you would get on a traditional car. But I'd have to go back and see the film to comment, because it didn't stand out to me at the time that I saw it.
Maybe it was one of those things too, where it was like I was getting so into the movie, and then I'm like, oh cool, we're getting into a great race moment, and there's this crash, and maybe just it's sort of the, you know, the trained eye of somebody who does this stuff for, you know, had done this kind of work for a long time. It's just I immediately am looking for something that you know, in a way that like I kind of probably shouldn't be, because later on I got so much further into the narrative and so much more absorbed in the film that I think, you know, I was still looking at things, you know, as critically as I could, but at the same time, you know, it all just started to really gel. So it could have been one of those things too, where maybe it was just I wasn't quite in the zone yet or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that they did treat the environments a little heavier in terms of kind of look and atmos and other things, because they were trying sometimes, like I'm thinking particularly in the Tokyo one with the rain. Mm-hmm. I felt that was really successful in the story, but it just felt like a couple of the visual effect shots that I was pretty sure were not stock footage but were visual effect shots were sort of impossibly wonderfully graded shots. You could see like Fuji in the background and kind of rain and stuff, but I'm thinking...
Or Canon.
Sorry?
Where it said Canon like 40 times across the arena, and we all know that Ron Howard does a ton of work with Canon. And granted, it was Japan.
It was
but
Japan.
But still, yeah.
Okay, but no, I wasn't the product placement, if it was product placement. No, it was just the fact that it was a too beautifully composed shot for stock footage. I mean, if that had actually been stock footage, maybe it was, then the guy on the day, 30, 40, 50 years ago, really just lucked out. I mean, really scored.
Well, and
it wasn't that.
The other thing that's kind of tough, too, that, you know, in all the environments, especially the establishing shots, and we saw this at least three times, I think, where there's a sky replacement that's done, right? And it's a pretty heavy-duty sky replacement with a pretty heavy-duty grade as well. And I think that that was something that was certainly was interesting to see. It reminded me of the really heavy sort of, you know, Scott-free kind of Tony Scott grades, like from Days of Thunder, where it would have, like, literally these planes of color, you know, where it's like an actual grade filter or something. And, you know, it kind of had that flavor to it, which, I don't know, in a way also maybe isn't inappropriate in that it sort of it feels like almost a, you know, a trope of a racing film.
Yeah, I mean, it is hard, isn't it? You've got those sort of classic skies that would be quite often, when you're exposing for the way they're doing them, quite dull. You make them really interesting, and then people like me criticize them because they look too pretty. And
yeah, well, it looks like a big HDR or something, right?
Yeah, and I only got that really heavily in the Tokyo track setup, where I just felt like it was a bit much. You know, I had that almost feel like, you remember the days where we used to get really amazing matte paintings, and no one would want to degrade them too much because they were such a great matte painting.
Sure.
So it didn't feel like it was doing it justice, but in reality, you wouldn't see them.
You know, it does speak to something about, I think, in totality, though, the film as a whole, including the visual effects. Like, this is a very, I think, a very stylish movie. It has an amazing style to it that isn't
Absolutely.
Necessarily, you know, an attempt at a hyper realism. It's an attempt at telling a very real story, but I think it's also an extremely stylized vision of this world and of this time. And I think that in that respect, those skies, you know, I don't know if I think they kind of work in that way.
The Tokyo, I felt like the Tokyo section was the most modern looking section. It was like much sharper than the rest, especially the Phantom stuff, which looked incredible. Like the slow motion rain with that, like tons of depth of field of rain with the guys in the back and the rain all falling. I my mouth literally opened when I saw that shot. And I said out loud to myself, because I was there, I wasn't there with anybody that I knew. I just went, whoa.
Well, that and then the shots of the cars, like, starting in the race.
Yeah.
And as the rain's coming down, the wheels are spinning, and the rain shooting up in columns off of the two back tires in particular, right? And I think that, again, that's a very, you know, stylish aesthetic. You know, what you said, though, about the it was sort of the sharpest in some ways, too. This actually was something I was curious about. And I don't know if, Mike, when you talked to the DP, if this is something that you guys touched on at all, but do you think they, or if you guys had an opinion about it either, but do you think they sort of took their foot off the gas with the grade as we moved further and further in the film? Because I felt like the grade got less and less, and I actually felt like in the sequence in the airplane hangar, I felt like the grade was almost, you know, less than half of what it had been earlier in the film. I don't know if you guys felt that way at all, but...
No, not until you mention it. Now you say it, I do remember that aircraft hangar scene having just such... But maybe that was because it felt to me like it was just such a real moment without any clutter of stuff that they kind of stripped everything back.
Well, I wondered, too, if maybe they were removing some of the grade as, like... I mean, this is maybe kind of corny, I don't know, but as time goes by, right? Like, so it's kind of becoming more modern or something, but anyway.
I felt that in the theater while I was watching it this morning. I did think that, and that's why I sort of brought up the Tokyo, that the look of the Tokyo stuff, even though it was really only like a year, or it started in 70s, that race was in 76, what was it, how many years did it go back in the beginning, was it 3 years or 6 years?
I can't say that off the top of my head.
I can't remember. Well, but it wasn't that long, right? It wasn't long enough that it would be a huge stylistic shift, but I did feel that in the Tokyo stuff was where it started getting a little more regular looking or normal, you know, film looks instead of the really crazy stuff they did in the beginning, which I absolutely loved. And also Niki Lauda's vision treatment in the in the Tokyo race also was really good. Like, it made you, because all the other ones were consistent, and now all of a sudden you're like, I can't see what's going on, which means he can't see what's going on, and now I'm really nervous.
Yeah, when you look at those cars and the rain, I was like, hang on a second, I never thought about this before. Like, these guys don't have windshield wipers, they don't have enclosed cabins, they don't have...
Yeah, when they were drilling the holes in his helmet, and they did the inside shot with the bit going like right at his...
Hey, Matt, this is something that you I'll get you to talk about, but one of the things I kept on thinking about, and I then actually Ian from our team wrote up about, thought was really interesting, is I sort of felt sorry for and admired the work of DNEG in terms of reflection maps and stuff that they were doing, because in a normal environment like what I'm in right now, like, we can take a reflection map and we put a digital object here in front of us and you guys are going to get it looking realistic and it's going to reflect everything. Move through the space at 300 miles an hour or whatever it is, or 300 kilometers an hour, and suddenly I need a lot of reflection maps. And so they actually put cars on the ground and sort of, you know, drove slowly, taking series and series of stills to kind of, you know, produce these massively long reflection maps and stuff to do. Like, there is an actual complexity to trying to do visual effects when you, either the model is covering a lot of ground, so you need a lot of background, or you just need to sit with the actual model, maybe the car, but just have tons of reflections by, and it's just not a simple problem to...
You bet, and I think, the delivery, the race... I mean, this movie is, all about the characters, but it really, it all is sort of encapsulated for us, the viewers, and has made an exciting sort of cinematic narrative through the racing scenes. And the amount of visual effects and the success of the visual effects in those sequences. And I do think, too, like I said before, there really needs to be, I think, a large tip of the hat, too, to the editorial team in terms of how they cut those sequences together, because I think that really added to... the frenetic pace and the kind of sense of drama in those scenes. But yeah, I mean, it made me think too, when you're mentioning the reflection maps and stuff, I remember watching, it's kind of a funny one to bring up, but it is, another race movie. But when the first Pixar Cars movie, the opening race sequence, I remember watching that where they're racing the kind of, Talladega Nights racetrack or whatever, where it's the NASCARs at night racing around the track. And I remember watching that sequence in the theater and with my son, who was, I guess, maybe 3 or 4 at the time, and watching that and being just really blown away at the materials that were placed on the cars, and then the way the lights were playing off the vehicles, and how incredibly successful it was, even though that the car windshields had eyes, right? Like, it still looked incredibly photoreal. And if you go and even look at real-time rendering in a lot of sort of the current state of computer games, if you look at real-time rendering in racing games like the Need for Speed series or any of these other kind of racing games, oftentimes I find that the racing games themselves wind up being the ones that have the most kind of almost freakishly photorealistic graphics. And I think it kind of stems from the fact that you're dealing with, hard surface models for the most part that are fixed and don't have any real moving parts, maybe other than, the wheels, right, or some sort of little driver movement in the cockpit. And I think that lends itself, I would argue, maybe to a certain kind of success in rendering, where you get an aesthetic that is... something that we're very used to seeing. Anybody who spends any time riding in a car, you're very used to seeing a certain kind of look of lights and reflections and stuff bouncing off all the sort of reflective surfaces as you drive. And so replicating that digitally, I think, is something that, computer graphics artists, both, places like DNEG, as well as a lot of these game companies, it's a thing we've gotten really good at doing and doing well.
Yeah, I've got to say, the real-time rendering stuff that you're talking about, is a great example. But, of course, it has a huge advantage that they own the digital environment.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, absolutely.
Any point is really easy.
Good
which
point.
I think just underlines my point, which is that once you start moving a digital car around a track or moving a digital track around a car, you actually have to do a lot more work to get those reflections to the cell. And cell is vital, or that is vital to the cell. So, yeah. You mentioned a shot you didn't like. There's one actually the DOP mentioned that he didn't like. But before I get to that, Jason, was there any shot you didn't like in the film?
I don't think anything jumped out at me as because I like I said earlier, I honestly did not have a clue how much visual effects were being done, because I don't know that much about the sport, so I don't know if the tracks are available. And you know, I think probably in reading, the most interesting tweak of a visual effect addition to a stock footage one was the helicopter shot from inside the helicopter. I thought it was really cool. In the article, they mentioned they had this more stable shot from the outside of a helicopter over the crowd, but there was some, the footage was too soft. It just wouldn't like play nice with the inner cutting. So Ron Howard apparently had the idea to say, okay, well, why don't we just model a helicopter and put the nose of the bubble and just, you know, there, and so we could push the footage off in depth of field and use it soft and have something in the cockpit. And I think, you know, that like creative uses of the stock footage with CG mixing like that is, to me, way more impressive than like a really good car model shot, right?
Yeah, it's a good point. Actually, it's a very inventive solution. The one that the DOP didn't like for reasons not non-technical was the when Niki Lauda has his breakthrough moment, as in he doesn't panic when the cars are crashing around him and he sort of breaks through and goes on to sort of regain his nerve, as it were. There's a ramping in that shot, and I think he felt that it was inappropriate because it was so non-period. I mean, that ramping stuff hit in the, 90s? And it's a very sort of, you know, it's like if the 60s had their zoom and seek thing where you could really tell there was a zoom going on, the 90s had ramping.
Sure.
Coming out.
That's so interesting because I don't even really remember that as a particular effect in the shot, you know, in terms of the ramp. Like I don't remember seeing it. I'm sure, you know, it's there. Like I just remember that sequence and thinking like, oh, that was pretty cool. I don't remember that as something that it didn't take me out of it visually.
I felt one ramp, and that was from the same shot, Matt, that you were talking about in Tokyo, as they're getting, because that's really where they used most of the slow motion stuff, was in Tokyo. And as they're getting going, they did a couple edits and a couple of great beauty shots in slow motion. And then as the cars were coming towards, I think they went to kind of a quarter shot, and it went like, and then you could feel them take off, which sort of was hidden by the fact that that's how a car would take off if it was spinning its wheels enough to get momentum and then stick and pull off. But it was a ramp shot. But I didn't feel the one that that the DOP brought up.
So the thing is, I don't think you need to be 100% in sync with the camera tech of the time. Like, I'd have no problem with the fact that they used high-speed photography that obviously wouldn't be of that period. You could have to do it on film, and even then it wouldn't look kind of the same way. Or that they had shots inside the engine, which are pretty obviously CG. So I don't have a problem that, you know, it's not like a sort of an exercise in how accurate can I be to the camera tech of the era. It's how true can I be to the feel of the era. So I think he was probably being a little unnecessarily harsh on himself.
That's the one other thing I would want to go back to, really, just ever so briefly, only to compliment it, was the I absolutely loved the shots of the CG shots of that were inside the engine of the vehicle. I love that stuff. And I love the way that it integrated into the cut, and you felt the, you know, the man and machine and the power of the engine and all that kind of stuff. And I thought the design and the execution of those shots, for me, they were gorgeous. I loved them. I thought they were so cool, and they were so stylishly done. I thought that stuff was just really great and added a lot of flavor to the film that you wouldn't have had without them.
It was sort of like the next step of like the Fincher photogrammetry thing that he does. It was like that, but like now brought into editorial,
but
even more.
But that being said, if you go back and watch the Saul Bass opening montage, which I think you can watch it on YouTube, to Frankenheimer's Grand Prix, the opening montage and the way it's constructed and the things that we see of like engine parts moving and the valve, and I think it begins I think where they go into an exhaust pipe of one of the vehicles and stuff, and it's so of that flavor too. Like, I think there really, there definitely is a, you know, a recognition of that, which I think is really one of the most famous sequences.
The filmmaker explicitly referenced.
Yeah.
Hey, so we got to finish up, but the good news is, if you like this film, many of the creatives involved in the film have gone on to Ron Howard's next film. So certainly the DOP and a bunch of other people, including, I think, Chris Hemsworth, have gone on to his next film. So that's
Which, by the way, his next film is probably one of the best books I've ever read, which is Nathaniel Philbrook's book, In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex, which is the true story that inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick. And it is an amazing and harrowing true story that is, like, it's a nonfiction book, but, man, it is a hell of a page-turner. Like, if they do, you know, half the justice to that they did to this story, like, it'll be amazing. I think it's great to hear that it's in such good hands.
Well, and Anthony Dodmantle, the DP, has a long history of digital, you know, like early digital filmmaking, right? With all the Swedish stuff.
So we've got to wind up.
Let's wind up.
Thank you so much for being with us. Matt, where are you at, and where can people follow you?
You can always find me at Virginia Commonwealth University in the School of the Arts, where I teach computer graphics, among other things. And then anything and everything me is on my website, which is mattwallen.com.
And Jason?
On my website with my brother, thediamondbros.com. And on the Twitters as Jason Diamond.
And, of course, you can find me over at FX Guide and at FX PhD, where we've just started a new term. The new term, interestingly, for people that are watching this and listening to this podcast, actually has, a course, one of our DOP series. We regularly do classes and courses on stuff to do with DOPs, and as well as visual effects. And so that is a great interest. It's one to do with the setting up of gripping and moving and the camera. I guess it's such a great tie-in, that physical moving the camera, into how you go about doing the visual effects work, in how you emulate a lot of that stuff, which, of course, is picked up by all our majority of our courses, which are, of course, visual effects courses covering Nuke, Moto, Cinema 4D, and a bunch of high-level courses this term, including, I recommended to you guys, a Victor's tracking course. It's like, if this film taught me anything, it's the importance of getting really good tracks for those environments. And Victor's does some amazing tracking with SUPOP survey data. So all that over at fxphd.com. Guys, thanks so much for being with us. And thank you, guys, those of you that were part of our test drive here on YouTube. As time goes on, as we perfect the technology, we'll make this a bigger event, and we'll probably give you more warning. But until then, of course, the audio is available through iTunes. Until then, I'm Mike Seymour. Thank you so much. It's been a rush. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com.